Jesse.
Crime.
Tea time.
Hey, hey, hey. What is up, you guys? Welcome back to another episode of Conspiracy, Crime, and Tea Time. I am Tara, and today we are talking about one of my favorite C's. Yes, a cult. Cults are my favorite because it's crazy, and I'm surprised I've never heard of this before. I'm using the term cult loosely. I mean, it still counts, okay? You'll see. So the guy we're talking about today, his name is Marcus Wesson. He's an American criminal convicted of 9 counts of first-degree murder, 14 sex crimes. He is somewhat of a cult leader and overall a dumpster fire for a person. He is the gold standard for crazy piece of shit, okay? So buckle up. It's going to be a ride. But of course, I want to kick it way back to Marcus when he grew up. Like, what happened to him? What made him turn out to be this fucked up of a person? And real, just a side note, I don't really, you know, how he grew up, it may have like a tiny bit of influence, but overall, he made his choices on his own. He was a grown-ass adult and he's disgusting and I hate him. Okay, so Marcus was born in Kansas. He was the eldest of 4 children, his dad, Benjamin, and mom, Carrie Wesson. So he followed his family from Missouri to Indiana to California. They were somewhat of drifters. His mother was a Seventh-day Adventist uphold teachings such as the infallibility of scripture, of atonement. They believe in the resurrection of the dead and justification by faith alone, and they are considered evangelical. So this isn't your regular weird sect of Christianity. This is straight up like, no judgment, okay? But to me, it's fucking weird. They're like, they're the weird ones in my personal opinion, okay? She has said his mother to be a religious fanatic. She would force feed her children daily Bible lessons. His father, Benjamin, could never hold a steady job. He stayed home. He would drink and he would disgustingly flirt with his own children. There was an abundance of evidence that Benjamin Wesson had possibly been gay. But back in those days, you know how it went. A childhood acquaintance of the family would later testify that the senior Wesson once paid him $50 as a child to submit to oral sex. Disgusting. He later ran off with a teenage male relative before returning to his wife and family a decade later. And it said, you know, that his dad was pretty abusive. His mom was also abusive. She would beat him with like cords and things like that. Not just Marcus, but his siblings as well. His dad subsequently left when Marcus was just a child. As a child, Marcus's favorite game was to play preacher, a pastime that he would perfect over the decades as he would eventually go on to read hours of scriptures to his children. After dropping out of high school, Marcus joined the army and he would serve from 1966 to 1968. He was honorably discharged from the Vietnam War. He was an army medic. He basically settled in San Jose, California once he left the army. So once in San Jose, he met and moved in with a lady named Rosemary Solorio. She was 13 years his senior. She already had 8 kids of her own. And then eventually their relationship would get a little spicier and they would have a son together. But 1974, Wesson would begin to sexually abuse one of Solorio's daughters. She was 8 years old and her name was Elizabeth. When Elizabeth was 14, so that went on basically from 8 years old throughout her whole life of being around Marcus. So when Elizabeth turned 14 and Wesson was 27, he impregnated her, and then they would go on to marry each other. And as I say marry each other, obviously she is a child. So there's not a lot of detail with his relationship with Rosemary. So I don't know if he was as crazy and manipulative with her as he would turn out to be eventually. But obviously no mother would willingly let their child marry a man unless there were other circumstances. So I'm going to give her the benefit of the doubt and say that she was probably being manipulated, because I read that they were waiting until she was like 14, Elizabeth was 14 or 15, for them to get married. So already just a lot of fuckery going on. So that would forever seal Elizabeth's fate as a subservient person to him being a domineering adult. Elizabeth has been quoted as saying that he told her she belonged to him and that she was already his wife before they even got married. Eventually, Elizabeth and Wesson would go on to have 10 children together. In 1989, one of Elizabeth's sisters would dump off her 7 children at the Wesson home because of her drug addiction, and she could no longer take care of them. Totaling the child count at this point to 16 in the Wesson household. And this is just the beginning of where things kind of start getting, like, if it wasn't weird enough already, they start getting weirder and more twisted and more warped. And that would be the outcome of Marcus Wesson and his family. So Marcus's worldview was a viciously sinister one. He believed society was full of sin and peril, and he cloistered his children to shield them from it. He was very controlling, very manipulative. He was fascinated with David Koresh, who was the cult leader from Waco, Texas, who took multiple wives. He was glued to the television during the federal siege on the group's compound in 1993, during which Koresh and his 80 followers died. He's quoted by his family as saying, "This is how the world is attacking God's people. This man is just like me. He's making children for the Lord. That's what we should be doing, making children for the Lord." Yeah, I'm going to stop you right there, Marcus. No, it's just a no. It's a no for me. Marcus was very abusive towards Elizabeth and his children. He prevented Elizabeth from participating in their upbringing at all. So just to note, before we get into the details, it's not like Elizabeth was complicit. Obviously, he married her when she was a child, you know, so she was not complicit in any of this abuse that was happening. She was manipulated. She is also a victim. Just to keep that in mind. So Wesson would not allow his children to go to public school where they may be tainted by sinners or wrongdoers. He took to making their lessons and he started homeschooling them. Most of their learning consisted of religious texts, of which Marcus would make up himself. It was his own little doctrine, of which he would use the Bible and he would basically twist it to fit his benefit. If Wesson's children didn't do their homework or Bible studies, he would hit them with a stick wrapped in duct tape or a small baseball bat. They weren't allowed to have friends. They were seldom allowed to leave the house. When the kids did cross paths with other people, they would not talk to them. They would not make eye contact with them. They essentially were leaving the impression that they were polite and well-behaved, but realistically, they were just very manipulated and stuck inside of this like vacuum of isolation. Wesson's numerous children were so well hidden that many neighbors didn't even know that they existed. A lot of his neighbors are quoted as saying, like, they didn't see any small children. They only saw the adults. So his kids had no real knowledge of the outside world. They only knew what they were taught. And that was Wesson's law, basically. Everything that he said, that was how it was. He told them that he was Jesus Christ. He demanded their unwavering obedience. His Bible studies and prayer sessions would last for hours. He's quoted as saying, "If you have seen God, you have seen me." Wesson commanded absolute obedience from his children and his wife. If you had transgressions, you would receive punishments. Some of his punishments would last for weeks or even months. A 30-day punishment involved 21 hits on your person And then that would be one time in the morning, one time in the afternoon, and one time before bed. And that would go on for 30 days. Over the years, Marcus Wesson collected bizarre beliefs and welded them together to create his own vision, which he imposed upon his growing family. He wrote his own version of the Bible, in which he claimed that Jesus was a vampire. He told his family the end was near, and he would also say that Jesus drank blood to become immortal, so he also must drink blood. The family watched dozens of vampire movies. They also took vampire middle names. Wesson did not see any conflict between his beliefs in a Christian God and vampires because they were both immortal. At one point during their upbringing, Wesson would segregate his household, forbidding brothers and sisters from associating with each other. According to his warped logic, he believed his children would develop sexual feelings for each other, which science tells you, not a fact. As a result, his sons would know very little about the twisted things that were happening between their father and their sisters. His son's interpretation of his parenting was adoration and respect because they were treated so much differently than their sisters, besides, of course, their occasional beatings if they did anything wrong. His daughters and nieces did not fare so well. The girls were forced to wash his dreadlocks, scratch his armpits and his belly, and they basically did whatever he asked. So it was a very much like, I jump, you say how high situation. So when his daughters and nieces were around the ages of 8 to 9, he would start molesting them. He would eventually escalate his behavior to full-on rape. He would call these routine rapes loving, and he told them that it was a father's way to show affection for his daughters. And mind you, they have no contact with the outside world. They have no knowledge of any different type of lifestyle. So these poor children are being subjected to this abuse and they don't even know that they're being abused. They had no knowledge, basically, that it was inappropriate. He justified his sickness by reading girls' Bible passages containing references to men with multiple wives. He would say, God wants a man to have more than one wife. And he would tell them that incest was making children for the Lord. Not long after Wesson started raping his daughters and nieces, he told them that he wanted to have a child with each of them. But of course, he could not stop himself at just having one child, and he continued to impregnate them. The young women viewed themselves as surrogates for Elizabeth Wesson, who could no longer have children. When the girls reached high school, he forbade them from talking to boys. Dating was out of the question. But of course, teenagers, they still had their own inclinations. And when Wesson discovered one of his nieces, Ruby Sanchez, flirting with boys, he beat her severely. Ruby ran away 3 times, but she always returned because she had nowhere to go and she already had a child in the Wesson household and she did not want to leave him. Eventually, Ruby Sanchez would leave for good and get married, and her sister, Sofina Solorio, would also end up leaving and leave her children there as well. Once they were away from Wesson's indoctrination, those young women finally realized what it was like to lead a normal life, and they realized that what they were living was not okay at all. They became furious when they learned that Wesson continued to impregnate their sisters and cousins, and they were worried about the welfare of their small children, especially because the family had no consistent income. The large family lived mostly off of welfare, and they would take shelter wherever they could find it. They would stay in an army tent, a trailer. I think I read they stayed in an army tent for like 12 years. They would live on broken down boats. Although his children were frequently reduced to digging through trash cans for food, Wesson would use money to buy fast food for himself. When the cops did end up arresting him, he was like 300 pounds. Meanwhile, his children are like making ramen noodles and whatever they can find in the trash can. Once his children were of the age to get jobs, he would force them to go to work, and then they would have to turn over their money to him. His excuse for not working was that he would stop receiving welfare if he had a job, which, you know, it's kind of how the thing works. You should have a job so you don't have to have welfare. But he's also quoted as saying that he shunned money because he said that there was a better way. He said, give your heart to God and he will provide. And I guess by that he meant your children will provide for you. The family also lived on a 23-foot sailboat that was permanently moored in the Santa Cruz Marina. The kids would scrounge for bottles and cans on the beach to turn in for recycling money, and they would also bathe in public restrooms. Local officials soon caught wind that the sailboat owner was living off public generosity, and in 1989, Weston was charged with welfare fraud and perjury. He pleaded guilty, and he only spent 6 months in the county jail. By the fall of 2003, the family had moved onto a 63-foot tugboat in Tomales Bay, an hour north of San Francisco. The concrete and wood boat was rotting and did not have a bathroom. In the tiny village of Marshall, where it was stationed, the Weston family stood out as eccentric loners. The sight of Weston's girls was very, for the time, concerning. They had long black skirts on and they would wear veils. They would row their father to shore in their little boat. And a lot of people took notice of that because it was fucking weird. Observers are quoted as saying that they rowed him to shore like they were his slaves. And they also are quoted as saying that they thought they were like some weird Jonestown cult, which they kind of are. The kids would keep to themselves. They rarely would talk to anybody. Residents would notice, though, that several of the girls had lisps. And even in hot weather, they wore clothes covering their bodies from neck to ankle. And then also at one point, four or five of the girls were pregnant. In the fall of 2003, sheriff's deputies ruled the tugboat unsafe for children, and he ordered them to vacate. The family would then move to Fresno, where they bought a 1,000-square-foot converted office building, and they also would have a yellow school bus parked in their driveway for transportation, I'm assuming. City officials told Wesson that the school bus was too large to park it in the neighborhood and that their home did not meet standards for residential housing, so they were given until March 12, 2004 to resolve these zoning issues. Which also just so happens to be the same day that Ruby Sanchez and her sister came to take custody of their children and free them from this crazy vampire cult. So the sisters knew that it was going to be an uphill battle when they arrived to the house to get the kids. Marcus had made a deal with them. If they ever abandoned his home, that they had to leave their children behind. And in the event that child services or another government agency came to split up the family, or if the authorities tried to remove the children, Weston told his daughters and nieces to murder their children and then kill themselves. And of course, he would stay alive because he had to explain the decision to the public. Solario said that the family held monthly meetings to discuss the details of their suicide pact, including how to shoot and how to kill. Also, Marcus had already purchased 12 mahogany coffins at an antique store. As Sofina Solario and Ruby Sanchez pulled up to the Weston house around 2 p.m. on March 12th, accompanied by several carloads of people, they went to the door and Sofina said, "I came to get my son." She rushed into the house to find her 7-year-old son, Jonathan. She had the boy by the hand and was walking out of the house when her sister, Rosa, snatched him away and stuck him in the back bedroom with the other children. Solario was pushed from the house. Weston stationed his massive frame in the doorway to block her from re-entering, which, again, remember, 300 pounds. Weston's supporters called the two sisters whores and bitches and ordered them to leave. Sabrina Weston pointed at their father's feet and told Ruby Sanchez to bow down to her master before running into the back bedroom with the children. So at 2:30, A squad car eventually pulls up to the house because a crowd is forming and they're trying to figure out what exactly is going on. One of the responding officers would later say he heard a baby crying as he spoke with Marcus Wesson in the doorway. But of course, Marcus did not invite the officers inside, and they wouldn't allow them to enter without a warrant or reasonable fear for public safety. And again, at this point, you know, the cops don't really know anything. And it's noted that they've only visited the Wesson house two times. So it's not like they were like on the police radar for being like weird or anything like that. So the lead officer felt as if Marcus was being compliant and he wanted a peaceful resolution to the situation. And Marcus agreed to let the kids go, but he said he first wanted to say goodbye to them. So he shut the door. And then the officers waited for an hour and a half before Wesson came back out. Ruby and Sophina were telling the cops that he has a gun, he's going to hurt the kids. So they eventually ended up calling the SWAT team for backup. The police ordered the crowd to disperse and take cover and protect themselves, basically, because at this point they were feeling like it might turn into a standoff. Several witnesses reported hearing gunshots inside of the house. The damning implication was that the police didn't move to stop the massacre once it began, but for whatever reason, all of the officers present said that they did not hear gunshots. All of these witnesses say, no, we heard him firing shots, and the cops, supported by their police chief, mind you, said, no, we didn't hear nothing. Wesson then walked out of the house covered in blood. In the aftermath, police discovered 9 bodies, including 2 of Wesson's daughters and a total of 7 of his children. Each victim had been fatally shot through the eye. So at this point, they're trying to figure out who is who, why are there so many kids in here, and they ended up running DNA tests, which would then uncover that Wesson was essentially the father to all of the children, including the children that his older daughters had given birth to. So this went pretty public, and Ruby and Sophina would do interviews about this situation and what they went through. And one of the news reporters actually let them move in with her. I believe it was those two and their children, if I'm not mistaken, but she moved in with this journalist because she felt so bad for them. They had nowhere to go. I can't even imagine. They have no knowledge of life. They don't know, like, anything. You know, they've just been trapped inside of this vampire cult for their whole life. So Wesson would go to trial, and he would plead not guilty because, of course, he's a fucking narcissist, and he could never be the one. He would never take the blame. His defense was that the mother of his children killed them and then herself, which was part of their pact, but the jury did not give a shit, okay? Even he had members of his family who still supported and believed in him, and they defended him in court, saying that he was, you know, no way that he was the one who did it. He was such a good dad. He, of course, it was his sons, you know. He's such a good dad. He's so supportive. He's so gentle. He loves them, this, this, and this. But again, the jury decided that Wesson was guilty. A lot of Charles Manson vibes, you know. They were like, we don't care who pulled the trigger. You're the one who influenced the situation. He's the one who manipulated them. He's the one who made the suicide pact. He indoctrinated them into this weird lifestyle that none of them, you know, would have been involved in without him. Subsequently, Wesson would be sentenced in 2005, and as of 2020, he still awaits execution. He's sitting on death row, which realistically is for the best. He is a crazy menace to society, and I cannot imagine the type of fuckery he would get up to if he was let out of prison or didn't get convicted. And that's the that on that. That is Marcus Wesson, his vampire cult. I do wish I had more details about the vampire cult. Like, I really looked. I mean, I didn't read the book. I know there's a book about him, but, like, I don't read fast. So, But, yeah, I wanted to find details. Like, did he actually drink somebody's blood because, you know, I mentioned that earlier. I couldn't find anything where any of his kids said he actually drank blood, but, like, I mean, I wouldn't put it past him. You know what I'm saying? Pretty weird stuff. But I'm here for it, and I hope, you know, Marcus Wesson rots his ass in prison. Know what I'm saying? And, yeah, I appreciate you guys for listening. And let me know your thoughts, your feelings, your opinions. Have you heard of Marcus Wesson before? Because I had not until I started looking, you know, into true crime things. Coming up, I do want to talk about the situation that led to Wes Craven creating Nightmare on Elm Street. I'm very pumped about that one. I'm trying to determine if it has enough to be a full episode or if I should just do like a sus Saturday because it is a very weird situation. But yeah. And I will see you guys next time. I appreciate your support a lot. Go follow my Instagram or the podcast Instagram. I'm really fucking up this outro. Give a follow. Give a share. Give anything. Anything will suffice. I just appreciate the love. Appreciate you guys for listening. And I'm going to see you next time. Bye.